This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome. It's Tuesday, time to talk politics. And I have to begin with kudos to two of our regular panelists, Sherry DeNovo and Lisa Raitt, who is away this week. And along with former Premier Kathleen Wynne, they asked Ottawa very publicly to commit $1 million to aid Israeli investigations into sexual violence perpetrated by Hamas against Israeli women on October the 7th and after. Now, Foreign Minister Melanie Joly made the announcement yesterday while she is on her trip to the Middle East. So I say, well done. And also, as Bob mentioned in his news, the former mayor of Calgary has set his sights on Alberta's top job. Naheed Nenshi, who has a very strong national profile, came out of political retirement announcing a run for Alberta's NDP leadership to challenge what he termed an immoral United Conservative government. And that, of course, is what we here on the Recovering Politicians panel might refer to as falling off the wagon. Anyway, going in the opposite direction, more Liberal MPs announcing they won't run again in the wake of plummeting poll numbers. So the numbers for you to call, 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740.
And now, the Recovering Politicians panel.
And now I'd like to welcome Sherry DeNovo, former Ontario NDP MPP, George Smitherman, a former Ontario Liberal cabinet minister and deputy premier, and Janet Ecker, a former Ontario PC MPP and finance minister. Welcome. Thanks for joining us, everybody.
Good day.
Let us begin with Sherry. Sherry, congratulations. You and Lisa and the former premier started this thing about 3 months ago, and it seems to have come to fruition yesterday. So what do you think?
Well, I think it's a good thing. And thank you to Madame Joly, because, you know, this is, and it shows the power of coming together in a post-partisan way about issues. I mean, something that, you know, I managed to get most of my bills passed that way when I was at in the Ontario legislature, and it clearly works federally as well. So, I mean, I look forward to more cooperation, particularly around women's issues with other women from other parties. But yes, it's a good thing. And hopefully some healing will come from this for those who, if not victimized, watched those who were. I mean, we're talking about people who have serious issues with trauma right now. And so, again, healing and obviously, you know, a real shining light upon using sexual violence as a weapon of war.
And Janet, I mean, $1 million in any kind of aid world is not a lot of money. But what people are very happy about is that this really goes a long way to showing credibility and to countering this wave of denial that this ever happened, including from other women who are pro-Palestinian or pro-Hamas. So that seems to be one of the key reasons that people are very excited about this, even though the dollar amount is small.
Oh, yeah, it is very small. But listen, let's give credit where credit is due. I think it's a good thing. I think Penny and Lisa and the colleagues that worked, Kathleen worked on this, wonderful that they did it. And, you know, nonpartisanship can work from time to time and work well. So, yes, it's a small amount. Hopefully the government will see a fit to do more. Unfortunately, they seem willing to you know, restart funding to the UN agency before the investigation is done, in terms of that agency's involvement in the atrocities and what happened over there. That's unfortunate, but kudos for the money, because it'll help. I mean, we can only imagine the trauma that these women and their loved ones have gone through.
Absolutely. And let's talk about that funding. The announcement that Canada, and I'm putting this in air quotes, was resuming funding came late on a Friday afternoon, which is always the place to bury news that might not be well received, more so because Jewish organizations were already closed for the Sabbath, George, and it's a fiction that Canada ever paused it, because the government rushed a payment out the door months early before making the announcement that they were pausing, and then was just about the first to announce resuming the funding. And it comes in a week when there was more evidence of UNRWA complicity with Hamas, in addition to the allegations about UNRWA members actually being involved in the massacre, and that includes phone conversations. You know, we've all seen pictures of like that big server farm or whatever you call it, like right under an UNRWA school. George, so what do you make of the Liberal government's handling of this?
What I think it speaks to is the overarching concern that many people have about the humanitarian circumstances that have unfolded in Gaza, and that there are probably very limited vehicles to actually deliver aid through. So I'm sure it was driven by a sense of necessity, notwithstanding that there are obviously a lot of concerns raised about their and some of the people affiliated with them participation in those events. I think that there is a significant degree of concern amongst many in the population with respect to the implications on the humanitarian ends, and, like I said, fairly limited means of delivering aid. So perhaps this is what's driven it. I just wanted to add my word of congratulations to those that the $1 million is part of it. But if you look back in December, when our colleagues, if we could call it that, you know, including Sherry, raised this issue, there was not as much a consensus around that these events had occurred, and I'd really credit them in elevating awareness of that issue in addition to playing this role of extracting these important resources. So kudos to them for their leadership.
I wholeheartedly agree with that. But back to the issue of relief. I mean, there's also, Sherry, evidence that Hamas sort of plunders the aid, takes the best stuff for itself. And there's also some evidence that some of that stuff gets resold. And even some other agencies have to subcontract with UNRWA. And, I mean, there is, fortunately, a big, huge ship in Cyprus has started to make its way to Gaza. But the holdup in Cyprus is also being blamed on Israel. It's not Israel.
Yeah, I mean, I'm with George on this. I mean, I think, world is kind of suffering along. I mean, we're talking about 13,000 children that have been killed since the siege on Gaza, and people are starving. There's precious little aid getting through, and I think that's what motivated the government, and what really is motivating a lot of international empathy and sympathy. There's no sight of the release of the hostages in all of this. Libby, I mean, there are many thousands on the streets in Israel protesting Netanyahu's handling of all of this. So I think that's where the move came from, maybe peremptory, but it's just in the absence of what can we do? What's getting through? Not a lot.
Well, yeah, but also the question is, what's the holdup? And yes, the demonstrations have started again. And my own take on it, I think Netanyahu is responsible for a lot of this. So it's not some kind of blind following of the government, but the holdups are in Egypt. And the agencies, a lot of the agencies are not capable of distributing this aid. So it's rankling when you see the only party being blamed for this is Israel.
Yeah, because it's not Israel. And I mean, I understand, you know, why Penny and George, you know, we hope it's a good interest that's caused the federal government to do this. But it's unbelievably naive. UNRWA has been part of the problem and is you know, being proved to be part of the problem. And yes, there's an investigation. So they had a way to say, okay, we're not going to do anything until an investigation is complete. And then they go and do it. And it's not because of problems. And yes, there are problems getting aid in. But giving money to UNRWA, as Libby's pointed out, is just replicating problems with that aid getting in. It's not going to solve the problem. So the naiveness of some of this, you know, our federal government's decisions, it boggles the mind, quite frankly, in terms of what they're trying to do. Everybody knows. I mean, there's people need that aid. Oh, my God, you can't see those CV pictures.
Absolutely.
Yeah, they need the aid. But let's deal with organized
nations. Maybe Janet should give us the list of all of those underutilized aid organizations that are on the ground in Gaza with capacity. Because I don't know what that list is,
George. It's not a question of underutilized. It's a question of, as Libby said, of people who are stealing the stuff, who are preventing aid from getting through, the problems in Egypt. Biden might actually have a solution. Biden's talking about trying to do some sort of pier or something.
Right, but that'll take a while.
Well, I agree, but at least it's fresh thinking. So funding UNRWA is not going to solve the problems we are seeing on the 6 o'clock news every night.
And there is a ship in Cyprus, I think it's Helping Hands or something, I forget the name of it, with a huge amount of aid on it, and it just got through Cyprus. So hopefully that goes some distance to getting the aid to the right people.
Yeah.
Closer to home. So what do you make of Naheed Nenshi running? Let's ask Sherry.
Well, I think it's a good thing. The more the merrier in a leadership race and high profile. I've met him myself. He seems like he did good things in Calgary. I think it's kind of funny that he was once called purple because, you know, the red and the blue were mixing there. And now we throw in orange, you know. But to the original point when we were talking about working across party lines, why say no to somebody that's talented and that's committed and that wants to do the job? I mean, we can also think of, you know, great people in history like Churchill who crossed the floor. Why not Nenshi? I think it's a good thing.
George?
I was always jealous of him because he used that purple to better effect than I did in practically the same the same election cycle. And I'm very interested. I read many stories yesterday, and I'll be very, very interested to see how he takes with kind of, if I could describe it, the NDP membership or the establishment of that party in Alberta, which I don't know well enough. There were quite a number of women MLAs that were already in the race, and the vote's coming up quite soon, etc. So I'm, as a political organizer, very intrigued to see what the means of success are likely to be for him. Obviously, he has profile. Obviously, he comes out of Calgary, which is kind of, I think, the election hotbed, if you will, in most of the recent elections. But I'm intrigued to know what the fit is for a guy that doesn't have a tradition at the organizational level within a political party and whether that can actually produce the votes on the day that you need to produce the votes, notwithstanding that he obviously has high profile and attracts a lot of attention.
Well, is it like these other races where you basically have to sign people up?
I imagine it comes down to the voting membership of the New Democrats. I think they have a date coming up, mid-April, something like that, very, very quickly. So, Is there going to be a groundswell of people that get out and do signups for him to flood the historic membership base of the NDP, etc.? I'm less certain about the success of those prospects, but I don't know that party very well in its Alberta context, so I couldn't say.
Janet and Sherry, do you know, is that the plan to just sign up a lot of people?
Well, that's, you know, that's at the end of the day, that's what counts, right? Whether it's bringing in, you know, signing, getting delegates to support you or selling memberships, you need that on the ground organization. And George is right that he's behind. I think the convention's in June, I think. I could be wrong on that. But so he's behind the other candidates. But first of all, anybody with some profile and track record and some substance, whether you agreed with everything he did or not, as mayor, the guy has a public track record to show he, you know, he can do things. That's a good thing in today's politics. So kudos for somebody of some substance running. But secondly, the issue he's going to have is that party leaderships are family affairs. And, you know, you got it. He may win. He may be a bigger win with the voters than he might be with the party delegates. We'll see. We'll see what happens. But sometimes party delegates can be pretty picky and choosy about who they sort of, quote, let into the family. So that'll be an interesting challenge for him. Can he catch up organizationally? And George has highlighted those challenges. But secondly, can he win over the family at the Thanksgiving dinner?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I guess it depends what they want. You know, I haven't heard of any of the other candidates and wasn't motivated to find out about them. Of course, I'm here in Ontario, so it doesn't really matter. But moving along, on the other side of things, we had the announcement that Tony Van Buren is not running again. He's had a couple of terms after being a mayor up in the GTA. And so is that just one example of what will be a rush to the exits of Liberal MPs based on polling numbers, George?
Well, you know, I note that by age, he's probably at a point where it's sensible to consider next steps. I mean, I do think one thing that's particular about politics is you're offering up 4 years at a time. So, you know, every election, you have to consider the implication of it all. But, you know, there's no doubt that folks are going to be contemplating what is shaping up for Liberals to look like a very, very tough election. And he's not in the primer points of the GTA for Liberal support. It's always an area where there's very close races between Liberals and Conservatives typically. So I know him, met him several times, but not enough to know his thinking on this. But you know, it's definitely you know, not a faint of heart election cycle for Liberals. Not for the faint of heart.
There's just something I want to bring up because it's annoying me, and that is bringing up his age. He's in his early 70s. You know, south of the border, the 76 or 77-year-old candidate is considered young and vigorous. I know lots of people in their early 70s who are extremely fit and, you know, can outrun much younger people. And it's not like being an MP is that physically taxing. So, you know, when I hear that kind of commentary, sorry?
I don't think that's what George meant, Libby. I think because you're absolutely right. I mean, you know, if the guy's healthy, hale and hearty, more power to him. But you have to think about your commitments. You know, it isn't a four-year chunk. But secondly, if you do lose an election, it's always tough to pick up the pieces and, you know, find a new job or what are you going to do next. And it is more challenging the older you get. So it's a reasonable thing for him to be thinking about in terms of, you know, the commitments and quitting, whatever. But it's not because he couldn't do the job. I think it's just a rational self-interest calculation, which he's entitled to have, because it will be a tough fight for the Liberals. And I think the pollsters are basically saying, again, things can change in over a year, but the pollsters are basically saying Canadians have made up their mind. They're just waiting to change the government to have the vote to do it. And so it's tough to say, yeah, I'm going to run under that banner when that's what the odds look like. It's not an easy game.
Yeah, I mean, and, you know, I wasn't just referring to George's passing comment. I've heard other commentary, you know, the guy's long in the tooth or whatever. And I just find that the ageism just bugs me.
Yeah, I agree, Libby. And I also think, quite frankly, that there will be a rush to the exit. And I that's just because of the polling. I think the Liberal brand has been, you know, really attacked, whether you like it or not, and it's been attacked effectively. I think the Trudeau brand in particular of liberalism has been attacked. It's kind of strange to me that they're not looking at perhaps a new leader at this point, and they still have a year. But I mean, you know, I think that that brand is going to take a whooping, and I think you're going to see not only, you know, Conservatives pick up seats, but I think you're going to see the NDP pick up seats in ridings that have been traditionally Liberal. And if they're reading the polling and they're reading and they're listening to people at the door, they're hearing that.
Well, you know, I'm thinking this is reminding me of 1984 with the big Conservative sweep. But I just to give out the numbers in the latest poll that was released yesterday, PCs at 39%, Liberals at 29%, and the NDP at 21%. So the Conservatives 10 points ahead of the Liberals. Does anybody have any comment on those numbers?
Well, all I can just say, all I can, 10 points sounds like a lot, but if you don't have a good campaign or you make a bad mistake, it can disappear like snow in the sunshine. So, and I think the Conservatives know that. I think they're nervous. Just, you know, can we hold this lead over the next, whatever, 12, 13, 16 months and during a campaign? So it's kind of cool to have it, but it's not a sure thing.
I just wanted to make a point back to the other, you know, the other thing that we were speaking about in the sense that, you know, it's a choice at a certain point between family and grandkids and 7 days a week, at least for certain seasons of the year. Like, maybe being a backbencher isn't as hard a work as being a cabinet minister, but to do politics properly requires you to be working 7 days a week for most of the seasons of the year. So it's appropriate that you might stop and say, well, is that really the best use of my of these 4 years of my life with all of the other options that are in front of me? And I think maybe that's just a bit of a different consideration for somebody who's 70 than somebody who's 45 or what have you. It's like, no doubt whatsoever, this is a capable man. He was the mayor for a long time. Public service is in his blood. But it's a costly piece of business from the standpoint of the implications for family. And I think all of us could attest to, all of us on this call could attest to, you know, some of what we forego for the work of being elected politicians.
That's a good point.
Before we go, last topic, Haiti, horrible situation there. Canada seems to be involved in trying to get some international either force or group together. Is this, I would say that over the last few years, I think Canada has really lost stature in foreign affairs. Is it coming back in this way, Janet?
Oh, it's going to take more than one, even if they're successful in Haiti and what they're trying to do, and kudos for trying to do it. But even if they are, it's going to take a long time to repair our international reputation from what it used to be. Trudeau has, in my view, damaged it seriously. Canada used to matter as a middle power broker, and we don't anymore, and it's unfortunate. And what I think is tough for a lot of Canadians is to understand why that matters. But it does matter. And so good luck on Haiti, but Trudeau's going to have to do a heck of a lot more to restore our international reputation.
Sherry?
I think it's way more than Trudeau. I mean, we've been, you know, since Aristide, you know, meddling in that country and with obviously not much success. It's a very, you know, complicated problem. I mean, to characterize all the resistance at gangs, I think might be an overstep. I think there's real resistance to someone who was never elected as, you know, the head of state. And there's all sorts of other economic problems there. So, yeah, we've meddled before, not at obviously effectively, and we'll see. Not just Trudeau. I think this is a problem of several administrations, Canadian ones, yeah, for sure.
George, what do you think?
Well, I think Trudeau actually on Haiti has played his hand well, because Biden has been trying to seduce Canada into taking a lead in Haiti, which is, I'm sure, well beyond our capabilities just because of the limited resource that we have for foreign activity and military and the like, and also just because it's such a complex spot. So appropriate to see Canada in the mix, but I'm one of those that thinks that Trudeau has been wise to resist the seductive temptations that must be there when the President of the United States is constantly encouraging you to take the lead in Haiti, which I'm certain has been the circumstance for a lot of the last 18 months or so. I just want to say, I'm not a religious person, but it seems that I should say, I want to say a prayer for the people of Haiti, who seem to have the worst run of luck in the Western Hemisphere for a good long time now. And I'm skeptical about the prospects for progress there, even with all of those various countries summoning up some resource here or there to help. There's something in the culture there that I just don't know how you get past, but I just have hope for the people in Haiti who are has been subjected now for so long to, you know, these just outrageously dire circumstances.
Well, I think we all have hope for the people of Haiti. And in addition to that situation, they've had these natural disasters. But I'm looking at the clock. Time to wrap things up. So thank you so much, Janet Ecker, Sherry DeNovo, and George Smitherman. We'll talk again soon.
Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, some really staggering numbers about food bank use. That's food insecurity. We'll talk to Neil Hetherington, the CEO of the Daily Bread Food Bank, when we come back.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. The numbers keep growing and are staggering. GTA food banks have hit record highs in the number of clients they are servicing. Toronto's Daily Bread Food Bank saw over 300,000 clients last month, and that's a jump from 215,000 in the same month last year. Operating costs are rising because of inflation, from $1.5 million spent yearly to buy food before the pandemic to $2.2 million last year. So the numbers to call, what do you think of this and what do you think should be done about it? The numbers, 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740. And now let's go to Daily Bread CEO Neil Hetherington. Hi, Neil.
Hi, Libby. It's always good to talk with you.
Thank you so much. Unfortunately, it's not good news we've got here. To what do you attribute the rise from one year to the next? There's big inflation, but it's actually eased since last year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So in your introduction, you talked about the fact that in February of 2023, 215,000 client visits. This year, 301,000. So the first time we surpassed 300,000 in a single month. There was one error just in the introduction, though, where we talked about the amount of food, the cost of the food that Daily Bread is paying on an annual basis. It went from 1.5 million, not to 2.2 million, but rather to $22 million.
Okay, my bad. You know what? I thought the 22, I thought I had a typo in there, even though I went over this. So sorry about that.
Not at all. I mean, but you're right. It's astonishing. It doesn't read correctly. And because you know, the fact that we've gone from $1.5 to $22 million, and in just about 3 months' time, at our year end, we'll be presenting to the board of directors a budget of $29 million for food. So your question was, like, what's causing this? Like, why is it that we continue, despite an easing, we've still got inflationary pressures, and out of the United States today, there is a bit of an uptick again, but an easing of inflationary pressures, why is it happening? And by and large, housing remains the number one concern, and we saw Deputy Prime Minister Freeland talk about that on April 16th, that the federal budget will be specifically paying a lot of attention to the affordable housing crisis that we all feel. And then the other thing that I'm hopeful for in the upcoming budget is the Canada Disability Benefit. In June of this past year, it was passed into law, but it was just a framework and there was no money behind it. And if you're disabled in Canada, specifically Ontario, you receive about $1,300 per month to survive on. And the poverty line is $2,300. The average bachelor apartment in Toronto is about $2,000. So folks are underwater immediately, even though they can't derive their income from employment. And so we're really very, very hopeful that that there'll be a fully funded Canada Disability Benefit so that we can start to see a decrease in the extraordinary numbers of people that Daily Bread has to serve across the city.
What about donated food? So I remember a time when the big grocers donated a huge amount of food. Has there been a drop in that? We're also seeing, food inflation is a lot worse than regular inflation, but we're also seeing these rescue apps. So regular people, I'm sorry, I phrased that badly. So people who are still able or to pay for groceries are shopping for discounted stuff that may have been donated before. Is there any truth to that?
Yeah, there is. So there has been a decrease in the amount of donated food. And we will at Daily Bread remain an opportunity for each of the grocery stores to divest of their wealth if they would like to continue to donate to the organization. We have seen individuals, making a drop in one of the iconic yellow Daily Bread bins across the city. That has decreased. And it's understandable. I mean, you think, it was only about 6 months ago that you could buy, a pack of pasta for about $1.25. It's about $2.25 now. And so it's understandable that people are challenged to be able to do that. The good news, however, and there's a little bit of good news, is that there continues to be a rallying of support for Daily Bread across the city so that we can provide the food to the some 200 food banks that we support. Folks are seeing the real issue of a lack of affordable housing and precarious employment. I think what is frustrating to me is there's a massive challenge, and if there were 300,000 folks without hydro, we'd send the army in. There are 300,000 folks who need, 1 in 10 Torontonians who has to make use of the food bank, and we are not taking the legislative steps required at all levels of government.
I'm looking at numbers, and the situation seems to be the same in Mississauga. They say about 8% of the city's population is affected, and I've said this before, often on the routes that I drive regularly, notably to Princess Margaret on College Street, I pass the north, the Fort York Food Bank, and there's always a huge lineup, which is very upsetting to see, and the people in the lineup are well-dressed. They look like they might be heading off to their minimum wage jobs after they get some food.
Yeah, I think you're entirely right. It is a sad state of affairs when somebody who has done everything right still has to go to a food bank. Here's a stat that I think is startling. The reality that 59% of food bank users have a post-secondary education. you know, Bill Clinton used to say that if you go to school and you get a job, you work hard, you'll be fine. That isn't true, not only in the United States, but in Canada anymore. Folks have gone through what they ought to. They may have accumulated debt. A $50,000 wage with a child, perhaps, and paying $2,400 for a one-bedroom apartment, you realize very quickly that your disposable income is gone.
So, Neil, just to wrap things up, what's your ask? Do you really need more donations or what?
I would say three things. We probably need prayer first. The next is we need to have everyone, anybody listening, I'm hopeful that they'll go to fundthebenefit.ca. That will put some pressure on the government to fund the Canada Disability Benefit so that those folks on disability can purchase their own food and have their right to food being realized. And that, you know, whether it's over the upcoming Easter long weekend, if people want to volunteer, we would love that. If people would donate and have the ability to donate food or funds, of course, we would use it and get it out into the community right away.
Okay, Neil Hetherington, let's hope this situation gets better. Thank you so much for that.
Thanks, Libby.
Bye-bye. We are taking another break, and when we come back, Kate Gate, that photo that was supposed to make things better, well, it's having the opposite effect. What do you think about it? Before we go to break, let me give you the numbers again, 416-360-0740, toll-free 1-866-740-4740, and we'll talk about the Princess of Wales and that family photo that was doctored when we come back.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Well, it was supposed to quell speculation and conspiracy theories about the health of Kate, the Princess of Wales. But the smiley family photo released for British Mother's Day has done the opposite. Major news agencies pulled it after noticing multiple anomalies caused by photoshopping. And then Kate issued an apology saying that, quote, just like other amateur photographers, she sometimes dabbles in editing. Well, that actually made things worse. And all of this may impact the trust people have in anything that comes out of the palace. So what do you think? The numbers to call, 416-360-0740, toll-free 1-866-740-4740. And joining me now, Leanne DeLapp, Toronto-based freelance fashion and culture writer and frequent contributor to Zoomer magazine, and Richard Berthelsen, royal commentator and expert in contemporary Canadian protocol and ceremony. Thank you both for joining us. Hello.
Hello.
Good afternoon.
Let us begin with Richard. So what is the impact of this, first of all, in Britain, where people are even more fascinated with this than we are?
Well, of course, this has been a huge story on the front pages of UK press now for about 3 days, you know, starting with the photo itself and then the pulling of the photo and now the response to the photo. Whether it goes on beyond that is going to be an open question. It's interesting to me, public opinion polling in the United Kingdom suggests that most Brits, you know, feel that the princess is owed a little bit of privacy and can kind of tell us what she thinks. She wants to tell us about her health. And, you know, a lot of comments I see from individuals is they don't totally understand the issue because they themselves probably Photoshop some family pics as well. Of course, there are some big issues with the dealing of the media and the credibility of the palace with the media and the photo services that have made this decision. And those are very significant issues for the palace to navigate going forward.
before we move to Leanne, the other question I have is, surely, I mean, they have a lot of staffers. Surely somebody looks at a photo before it's released as an official photo. Did they not notice?
Well, that's a good question. You know, the Kensington Palace has a separate press operation to Buckingham Palace. And it's really interesting. Buckingham Palace with the king, you know, got the media to come in and take a photo of him prior to Commonwealth Day and do the filming of the message. So that was a media created image. This is in a very different area. And, you know, the princess herself and the Prince of Wales, William and Catherine, made a decision fairly early on that a lot of family occasions, they were going to provide their own picture to the media from their and Catherine herself, who likes to dabble in photography. So there's every evidence to suggest that this has happened before, that they've done some modifications to photos because they saw them as family snaps and they wanted to get the best picture of their children. It wasn't really an issue. In yesterday's and Sunday's situation, much different thing because of the level of interest in her health and how she looks. So I think that they maybe kind of got complacent in how this has happened in the past. I think it was also striking that the apology came from the princess herself rather than staff. So I think that tells you a little bit about something about who thought this was a good idea.
Leanne, you know, just looking at the, quote, anomalies in the picture, you know, one thing I haven't heard mentioned, and I know, Leanne, you are a tall person, but it looks to me the way it's done, I mean, how long are her arms, the way they had the arms? And then there's also more conspiracy that the picture of the princess's face is actually from an old Vogue shoot.
Well, you know what? Honestly, I think this is just such a huge PR mess, and they've really hit it into their own goal here, because PR is a game of setting the narrative, and so they've set everything back so far. As somebody who worked at a fashion magazine, I was an editor of a fashion magazine in the early 2000s when digital media was just on the rise, and suddenly everybody was a Photoshop expert, and you started to be able to not trust everything. That's why I think it's so important that that news agencies and newspapers have stood up to this and looked at, you know, the 20 different problems on the photo and said, we can't run this.
Richard, I mean, we're entering the age of AI. Does anybody consider it a good thing that all of this was caught reasonably quickly?
Well, I think Leanne raises a good point. I mean, we do have a high expectation that our media, which various services, the press services, the image services, the wire services, are going to do a lot of fact-checking on things before they put something out. So I think that is important, and the palace has to consider that. As opposed to what they maybe put on their own website or their own social media that belongs to them. So I think that's important. And I think, as I say, you don't have to go very far into royal history. In fact, it's throughout royal history, images have been doctored by either portraitists or photographers or whatever. And had they issued an official photograph, that would very likely be doctored in some way as well. So it's a gray area for them, but they're going to have to work with what has been really some very, very clear lines now laid down by the press and wire services.
Okay, let's take a call from Bill. I think the board has to take it. Well, no, there we go. Bill, hi.
Hi. I think Kate, she was born for this position. She's probably the only really good thing about the monarchy at this point in time. She's a class act, and I think if everybody has to get on their high horse, all these pundits, all these media, whatever, to attack her over this, I haven't even seen the pictures. You know what? The woman's a class act. Leave her alone.
Okay. Thanks for that, Bill. Underlying the issue is that issue about the level of privacy, and there are all those conspiracy theories, but I have to say that she was in the hospital for a very long time for abdominal surgery. The only thing they said about it is that it was not cancer. and she's off for quite a while, and that could be just because she needs a break. But really, that's the underlying thing, and I don't think that people are really way off base when they say, it looks like that medical issue was worse than the palace seemed to let on. Leanne?
Oh, hi. Sorry,
hi.
We were cut off there. I do really believe that she has a right to medical privacy. But at the same time, with King Charles also out of commission, it's become this huge story. And I don't know, how much does the public have a right to know? If you're a taxpayer, she's not in the line of succession. Is that fair? But at the same time, people who do share information about their medical journeys, we found that it's been so helpful to everybody out there. So there are two sides to that.
Well, she's not in the line of succession. She'll become queen if Will becomes king after his father goes, Richard. And again, is there a widespread feeling that her medical condition has been underplayed, maybe by a lot?
Well, I think we just don't have information. I think it's really speculative to suggest that. And, you know, I think she has made a decision that, you know, her abdominal surgery is not going to be discussed on the front pages of the UK press. She does have three young children who also may have access to that press or hear about it through their schools and the other school children. So I think she's made a pretty clear decision in that regard. And I have to be honest with you, my information from most people I know in medical life is that abdominal surgery can have a fairly long return period. She may also have factored in children's school holidays and other things like that in deciding not to come back until around the Easter period, which is the end of this month. So I think she's in a very different position than the king, and I think this is one of the problems in this story, is that because the king issued quite a lot of information, but again, not all, she's being contrasted with that. But he's in a very different position. He is the head of state. The public does have a right to know. The public has a right to know about her husband, Prince William, as well. Less so her. We heard very little about the Duke of Edinburgh's condition during his lifetime. And she's really in an analogous position to him.
Leanne, what does she have to do, or does she have to do anything to repair this public relations nightmare?
I think, honestly, she was doing really well by staying above the fray. The release of this photo is what's caused the real problem. She was in the driver's seat, really, and her PR was working. Even though there was lots of speculation, they were just holding to a single line, like, you're not going to see her until Easter at the earliest. I think they did this to quell speculation and then just made this huge mess. So I actually do think she does need to appear now because of this scandal. I do think she does need to show herself.
Well, actually, Easter is really not that far off. It's in, 2-3 weeks. But then there was also something about her canceling an appearance in June, Richard.
Yeah, I think that's a situation where an agency of the British forces went ahead and said she's going to be somewhere where she hasn't necessarily confirmed. They don't think she was canceling. So I think that, you know, is a little bit of a minor issue. I mean, you know, I think she has, as Leanne said, you know, she did choose a strategy not to speak a lot about it. I think she's probably going to stick to that. I'm hoping that what she said and what the palace has said all along was that she was recovering, she was getting better, and that she'd be back sometime after Easter. I hope that remains true. If it doesn't, then obviously something different is going to have to happen. But I would think at this point that having had a little foray into playing to the crowd and playing to the media, the social media kind of entity, that didn't go that well for her either. So I'm not sure that she'll do so, but it's possible. We did see a brief shot of her yesterday traveling in a car with Prince William. So that may be the most that we see in the next few weeks, but it is possible that she may be seen elsewhere.
And do you think that she has to do anything more active to kind of get over this?
I think it's really going to depend how she comes out of this and how she returns to the public life and whether at a time and place of her choosing, she chooses to speak about this. She doesn't really speak about these kind of personal issues. That's not her style. And she's going to have to determine whether she does that when all is said and done. And I think the palace and both the Prince and Princess of Wales are going to have to consider whether this was the best strategy that they employed throughout this whole process in dealing with the situation.
And Leanne, is this going to have any kind of impact? I mean, people are fascinated with them all over the world, including here and certainly in Britain. Is this going to change any of that?
I think that people who have not previously paid attention to the royals are paying attention to this because we have such a huge fear of being duped, of AI, of being manipulated by PR people, of fake news. So I think it actually will change things going forward. I think that the palace was caught unprepared for the speed of modern life and the response of millions of people who have access to that picture. It was just as much Twitter sleuths or X sleuths who were finding the holes in the picture as were the professional photo editors.
Richard, do you agree with that?
I agree totally with it. I think it's. I think the palace has really been caught in a situation where two very significant members of the royal family were in a medical situation at exactly the same time. In fact, it was announced the very same morning. I don't think they really contemplated, you know, what might happen in that. And I think they're also really getting used to the idea of a much smaller royal family where the absence of these two figures has had a really significant impact on the work of the royal family and the representation of the crown. Now, on the other side of that, it's also showing us the work of some other members of the royal family in greater coverage, more coverage than they would have otherwise seen, because they're the only game now. And so we see a lot more of Queen Camilla. We see a lot more of other members of the royal family. But I think this has been very difficult for them to navigate. And again, who would have thought that two members of the family would be out during these months?
Leanne, anything you want to leave us with?
I do hope that we continue to have discussions about medical privacy, because I think it is a very separate issue from doctoring with photos. I mean, Kate's photos, they're going to go back over past photos, they're going to go back over future photos. But I think it's an opportunity to have an issue of a conversation about the issue of medical privacy, and that celebrities still do have a right to that.
Okay. On that note, we wrap things up. Thank you so much, Leanne DeLapp and Richard Berthelsen. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
And that is all the time we have for today.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.